The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Media Talk. I'm John Plunkett, and on today's show, more details emerge as Rupert Murdoch splits his News Corporation business into two. Netflix is diagnosed with arrested development after the return of the show garners, well, mixed reviews, and its share price takes a dive. And Rebecca Nicholson tells us why history on TV is indeed a laughing matter, with reviews of Psycho Bitches, Up the Women, and the return of Horrible Histories. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. And joining me this week is former director of the Press Complaints Commission, Stig Abel, now a partner at the Pagefield Consultancy, and Media Talk regular Maggie Brown. Welcome both.
Hello.
Maggie, you bring back exciting news from the States, not entirely media related.
No, well, do you want me to talk about twitching?
More twitching.
Yes, I can.
That was the
point
of the question, Maggie.
I can reliably inform you.
What other non-media
scoops have you got? I've seen a non-extinct form of life, apart from newspapers. And it was a piping plover.
A piping plover?
Yes, a piping plover overwinters in the Gulf of Mexico, and then it comes to nest in tiny little areas of Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, and Lake Huron.
And there aren't many piping plovers left.
No, and I just happen to be sitting almost, I think, on top of its nest. I hope I didn't disturb it too much. But
there's one fewer piping plover now.
Certainly got very cross.
Stig, no birds, but maybe a cup of hot piping coffee.
Well, I was pleased to see Twitter enthralled with the notion of Guardian Coffee being launched, which I understand it is from a container in Shoreditch. So you're targeting the trendy East London community, as ever, as you do in the newspaper.
Always.
And I believe they're going to be flocking to Shoreditch to taste Guardian coffee.
And is it free?
No. You charge for it, and that's what makes it very uncomfortable. A flat Mike White was one of the jokes that was going around Twitter to the delight of many.
Very good, but skinny lattes, maybe not.
The skinny lattes, what they were saying, that it goes against the Guardian's deeply held view about inappropriate body images. So we don't want to mention skinny at all at any point in the coffee ordering process.
Well, Media Talk coming from the Guardian's new coffee house in Shoreditch some week soon. I've got no doubt. But we start this week with News Corporation. Rupert Murdoch's business is to be split into two separate companies from the 28th of June, it's been revealed. And on Wednesday, he told shareholders in New York more about his plans. He admitted to making spectacular mistakes in the past, but went on to say, and this is not in the accent he used, "I've been given an extraordinary opportunity most people never get in their lifetime, the chance to do it all over again." Stig, 82 years old, and is going to do it all over again.
Yeah, I can't believe he's going to do it entirely all over again. I mean, it's interesting that he's splitting the company into the two parts, with the publishing not very, very profitable part and the very profitable 21st Century Fox, which is the film and TV. And Robert Thompson, the whole general of the publishing arm, spoke to investors and talked about a dramatic pursuit of cost cutting that's going to take place in the publishing arm. So for the journalists who would have been hearing that after what's really been an extraordinarily bad year, if you work for a Murdoch title in the UK, or a bad 2 or 3 years, it seemed to be quite a positive start that you get your own company and it would be a relaunch again. But the first thing that was discussed is a new raft of cost cutting across the whole business, which may or may not fall in the UK.
Not the clarion call we might have hoped for.
Well, no, and it was to investors, and I'm sure investors do want to be reassured about that, because lots of titles obviously lose a lot of money. The Times loses a vast amount of money, and they do need to turn that around if they're going to try and make that at least come close to breaking even. But from a morale point of view, if you're a journalist for a Murdoch title, if the first thing that you hear about the new venture is cost-cutting, it would be a little bit of a kick, I'd have thought.
So, Maggie, News Corporation is no more in one sense. We've got the entertainment on one side, which is going to be 20... That's right. And all the publishing on the other side, News Corp. But what's the background to this? Does it all stretch back to phone hacking, or does it go back further than that? Or why has he done it?
Well, I think it's because the two categories of assets are producing very different results, as we've just heard, that the publishing side clearly is the old world, and perhaps the entertainment and film, which is very profitable but smaller in terms of capital value, may well be the future. This isn't actually, though, quite as we expected. As I studied it, and indeed as it was being discussed in America, more digital assets have been put into the what you might have called the newspaper side than people expected. There are the two Murdoch brothers, Lachlan and James, definitely attached to that side as well, and there's also a poison pill aspect of it to prevent investors coming in and taking or wresting control from the Murdoch family. And finally, of course, this possibly opens the gateway to the entertainment, television, Fox News, all the rest of it side, having another pop at Be Sky B, if that is in fact the corporate plan. It's one of those moments when you... I mean, I'm sure I'm not the only person who thinks this. How long can an 82-year-old really preside over this behemoth? And what on earth is the future really going to hold for the assets contained in both sides? It's hard to see this continuing. Furthermore, we know that John Malone is gearing up very much through his Liberty Media, having purchased Virgin Media, to have a go at subscription pay television in Europe, not just in the UK. So there are a lot of challenges around for this organisation, powerful though it is.
Stig, is there a sense that the publishing businesses are being lined up for a sale?
I don't know. I mean, there's a sense. I wondered whether you would demerge the companies to try and avoid the risk of contagion going across from phone hacking and all the possible legal ramifications in the States to cross over into the Fox business, which is vastly
profitable. I think it accelerated this move, but I think it's more fundamental than that.
Well, the thing is, it's always been said to me that Rupert Murdoch loves newspapers, always has loved newspapers, and therefore he would not necessarily countenance a sale. But as you say, he's 82 years old. The split of the companies may mean that when Rupert Murdoch goes, his sons don't love newspapers. James famously despised the News of the World even before any of this happened. Doesn't really feel the sort of news print flowing through him in the same way that Rupert does. So everything I hear always says that he still retains his love of the game, Rupert, and so that's what would remain for now. But he's 82 years old, and the succession plan is not entirely clear, I don't think, and there's no guarantee that the people who take over from him in these businesses would necessarily want to preserve the newspaper on.
No, and of course the question is, even if they wish to clean up further in the newspaper business in America by buying more titles, there is a problem of monopoly. And furthermore, there's no clear plan yet really for a newspaper industry revival across the States, as far as I can see. I was staying in Cleveland, Ohio, which has one of the very old newspapers, Plain Dealer. Mm-hmm. And even as I was there, it announced it was going from 7 days a week to a 3-day-a-week operation. You can just see really what the future is. It's fine for catch-ups and for weekend leisurely reading, but everyday news is going to be conveyed online.
And actually, it was in Cleveland where those women were abducted. And I remember I actually went to the Cleveland Plain Dealer
website.
To watch the updates. And in fact, he went to the Guardian website. The Guardian live blog was more or less just redirecting stuff from the Cleveland Plain Dealer website. And so when moments like that happen, you do want to have reliable local journalists, but they might become increasingly thin on the ground.
It's actually on that one story that the local folks of Cleveland have already raised $650,000 to help the three women. And there was also a story about what happened to Castro's now abandoned pet dogs. I think they're all being rehoused or rehomed.
Well, that's good to know. Thank you, Maggie. Well, from one breaking news story to another, I guess. It's another press news. More than 80 people have complained to the Press Complaints Commission after those graphic front page pictures were published last week of the Woolwich killing. It's something we mentioned in last week's podcast, Dig. Roy Greenslade issued a staunch defence of what they did. You're an ex-PCC man. What was your take?
Well, I actually think it's really important to show what happened. When something like that happens on the streets of the capital of the country, I think it's very important to show it. And I think you can tie yourself in knots sometimes by saying we don't want to give these people propaganda. And actually, if you saw these guys, I think they were condemned out of their own mouths. They weren't articulating a particularly well thought out view of the world, to say the very least. They weren't persuasive. They weren't articulate. They were maniacs, and they came across as maniacs. And I think if you worry too much, which is what some of the complaints are about, that you're giving too much attention to people who are so desperately clamouring for it, you're somehow making them win. I don't really buy. I think that if something like this brutal murder happens on our streets, we should know about it. But I was doing Sky News the night of Woolwich. It was interesting. They didn't show the video that ITN had. ITN had it, and then everyone lifted it, including the BBC quite late on. But Sky took an editorial ethical decision, which I thought was very interesting, not to run it on the grounds both of taste, because they're worried about upsetting their viewers, but also not to give these people sort of propaganda win. I'm not entirely sure I agree with it, but it was interesting they took a very strong ethical editorial position. I think newspapers, and I think The Guardian was a good example of that. I think they're right to show the stark reality of what happened. And I see Chris Elliott, the Reader's editor, kind of mounted a semi-recognition that it upset some people. He didn't quite say what he really thought about it, but I thought they were very powerful front pages, including the I thought the Guardians and the Mails were very powerful front pages, and I think they're right to run them.
Yeah, you mentioned Sky there, Maggie. I think Sky used a still image, didn't they, of the incident, and nothing more. I think the following day they then used video, but with the knife or whatever blurred out.
Well, I'm afraid I was relying on American news.
Well, what was the take?
BBC
in America,
Service.
Maybe?
Oh, they were very interested in it, and given that this is a country that prefers its own news, and they were having massive tornadoes going on all over the place. No, there was a very, very big interest in it, partly, I think, because at the same time, remember, President Obama made a very long, hour-long speech about drones and the use of drones, the more ethical, you might call, if that could be possible, use of drones to target foreign terrorists at the same, virtually on the at the same point. And why it had such a chord, I think, with American listeners and viewers is that they have just had the Boston Marathon atrocity, and it seemed to chime with this view that, in a way, the biggest danger now is not so much coordinated attacks organised from abroad, but from the almost like, whether you call them renegade or lone wolf or misguided youth of either America or, as we saw in Woolwich, of the UK. So there was a huge interest in it. My view is that you cannot overly edit an atrocity like this, which has taken place in plain view in a very busy street, which so many people witnessed. And there are moments when we do need to be restrained. But I thought the full frontal coverage was the correct one to take in this case.
The other point that's worth bearing in mind, which I think the PCC would be more interested in, will be the family of the dead soldier, which is that they need to be protected from people bothering them. And from everything I've seen, that probably has happened. They'll have been protected from people knocking on their door too much if they didn't want to speak. And they did speak, and they were very eloquent, and now I hope they'll be left alone. And that, I think, is more of an important ethical issue, is dealing with the people at the centre of it, the victims and their families.
But just one further point, too. The Americans were very taken by the boldness and the charity, really, of the three women. And they were obviously women of colour as well, or two of the women. I think that was a major, almost like an extra factor which humanised the story, given the horrible nature of the crime itself.
OK, thank you, Maggie. Finally, in our press roundup this week, two stories closer to home. There's the launch of the Guardian's Australia edition, which happened this week, and also the news of a move from guardian.co.uk, as many of you will be logging on, but to theguardian.com. But Maggie, you've been on America, so you've been reading the Guardian's American edition, a sign
indeed
of the global times we live in.
Yes, I have. I mean, I have two thoughts about this. Of course, it's great that The Guardian is going international, because it's a brand that we respect, and we know that we all do our best to report with integrity and truth, and that we comment with a liberal point of view. The only problem I have, and I say this also on behalf of certainly I was visiting my daughter, is that there is a lot of American news around. There's plenty of news online of an American kind, and one thing that shouldn't get lost is when you actually turn to theguardian.com, you do want to somehow retain that, I would say, almost British take, because that is actually what makes it special. And I found it personally somewhat frustrating that in the order of stories, you would get American stories, perhaps second or even leading. And I think that I haven't really had a chance to sample the Australian take on things. And clearly, you do have to have a raft of really good expert Australian journalists, which is what The Guardian has recruited. But I would still plead that what people turn to is something which isn't of an American sensibility. You want to keep that British Guardian flavour in there and not dilute it to such an extent that you actually have to go searching for what you might call the unique British stories.
And Stig, we're currently on The Guardian's currently on guardian.co.uk, guardiannews.com, and of course m.guardian.co.uk. And moving it to .com makes it easier for readers to find it. But how does a domain change sort of make a difference to the way you're viewed? You know, how do you handle that shift?
Well, there's an irony here, because British journalism is, of course, much bewailed at home, you know, with Leveson and all of that. And yet it is also conquering the world. And I think that you're right. Maggie, that the reason why you turn, and this is true not just for The Guardian, the reason you turn to The Telegraph, because it has a certain British right-wing approach to things, which you don't really get reproduced in America. The Daily Mail is one of the most popular websites in newspaper websites in the world because of that, some sort of bastard relationship between the US and the UK. So I think that what's important is there is this sense of a British voice, and the tradition in British newspapers, which is a sort of polemical campaigning archness, in taking a position and firmly withstanding it. I think that is the tradition that people are really wanting to see. If you go to America, apart from the New York Times, there's really no great newspaper of note at all. So
they can't write snappy headlines as well. I mean, it's really very noticeable that we have a much better way, maybe a slightly less respectful way with language. But I mean, our use of colour in adjectives, all the rest of it, and just snappiness is really, really noticeable. So we've got a lot going for us. I would just say, great, let's conquer the world as theguardian.com, but please remember what it is you're actually offering, which is a sense of Britishness and liberal values.
But presumably you want to make money from advertisers in the US, and that's the great conundrum on all of this, is yes. How do you make any of this pay? And I presume that the trick will be putting adverts in there that Americans will want to click on, and therefore that's how you get the revenue. So I totally understand that you are going to have to switch the mode of access to try and maximise the money. But you're right, if the British sort of tradition can continue, I think that would be the thing that you're worth clinging on to.
OK, well, we're back with more British and liberal views after this.
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition.
Leo Hickman meets Ingrid Leao Kennett, the woman dubbed the Woolwich Angel. Marcus de Sotoy on a big idea in physics. And in this week's audiobook review, we hear Antonia Fraser's Perilous Question and Daniel Dennett's Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking.
To subscribe for free to The Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud, iTunes and Audioboo. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Maggie and Stig are still with me, and let's take a look at some of the other media stories of the week. In TV news, Arrested Development was back, but not as it was before. The sitcom used to be on Fox, now it's on Netflix, and all 15 episodes of the new run became available at the same time. That was the good news. The bad news was that it got mixed reviews from critics and fans, and as a result, Netflix stock fell 6%. Stig, this isn't the sort of thing we see in the UK. Certainly ITV stock doesn't rise and fall so dramatically on the back of one series. But if it did, I'd have loved to have seen it when Celebrity Wrestling was on. But that's a long time ago.
I'd like to see Celebrity Wrestling again, actually, now that you mention it. I think it's extraordinary. But Netflix did this with House of Cards. That was their great the show, and that really did do so well for them. And I think it's extraordinary, though, that the share price can rise and fall based on the performance of one show, particularly bearing in mind, if you look at the reviews, they're not actually that bad. And there's one of those websites that aggregates the reviews, and it puts it at sort of 72 out of 100, which is in the good to very good scale. So I wonder if it's one of those blips as everyone's just getting used to this as a new approach, because I can't see the next time they produce a show, there'll be quite a bigger swing as a result of a poor review here and there.
Maggie, there was plenty of hype about it over here, but what was it like in the States?
Oh, gosh, it was hugely, hugely hyped. I mean, it seems to me it's that what's actually happening is that Netflix is almost using the kind of budgets that we see thrown behind a big, big movie. It was front page news in the New York Times arts and culture thing. And, of course, they released it on Monday, which was Veterans Day, which is a bank holiday, so that the idea was that, prosperous people would have their barbecue, and then they would maybe go inside, and if they were addicts, turn and watch, have a
marathon.
A marathon indeed on Arrested Development. One of the problems that Netflix has is that it said that, for example, House of Cards, when it was launched in February, helped drive subscriptions, maybe 2 million extra subscriptions. So it's a young company having to continually market itself as a forward growth subscription service at a point when in America cable fees are so high, monthly cable fees are so high, that there's a real reaction and kickback against it. So it has to get maximum juice out of any exclusive content like this. And in this case, it's said to have cost £200 million. It was always a cult show anyway. So the reason the stock falls is that unless it's superb and talked about and absolutely must have and we can't watch it any other way, it's not going to drive subscriptions. This is what it's about. What I dislike about Netflix is that it's not actually prepared to even release any figures about how many people actually watched it or downloaded it or did whatever or stored it or whatever they wanted to do with it. And I think that that is a sign of a kind of a weakness. I know it's a different business model, but it just doesn't seem transparent enough to me, if I was an investor anyway.
You have to take their sort of word for it when they say that more people watch House of Cards than, say, saw Mad Men on Sky Atlantic. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, without the stats... Yeah. Who's to say?
Would they ever do entirely original? Because I suppose House of Cards was a remake, effectively.
Yes.
And Arrested Development is a continuation of a
and they've done Sense8, which was a sort of sci-fi thing. So what they're doing is they're dropping into their mix of everything else, which isn't new, exclusive content to hook people in
subscription. But it's not exclusive content since it's not entirely brand new.
They may go on to... The reason Arrested Development ran for three series before Fox cancelled. And the ratings fell, but it had this kind of hardcore, what you might call trendies, who were watching it because of the nature of its kind of ultra reality comic stuff with
trendies.
John's eyes lit up when the word trendy was mentioned.
So it was addictive to those who loved it, and so that was the point about it, that they're hoping that they, you know, 7 years on, they grab back all the aficionados.
But would there be enough of them to make a big enough difference to the subscription?
Well, we just don't know.
Yeah,
that's the big dilemma for Netflix. Yeah, and also, it turns out there were apparently 100,000 illegal downloads of the series this week, still far less than there were of Game of Thrones, but still a major headache for content platforms and broadcasters. Which brings me on to a new Ofcom report, which said that almost a third of web users who stream or download content did so at least once illegally in a three-month period last year. So that's one in three downloading something illegally. I'm surprised. It's higher than I'd have thought. Maybe I'm naive and 41, which I am. Well, I'm definitely 41. Probably naive. Stig, are you either of those things?
I am naive. I'm probably one of the few people in the world. I've never downloaded anything illegally, but not because I'm a fine, moral, upstanding person, as you might guess. But I've never quite sort of grasped the urge to watch something so desperately that I've just wanted to go and do it. I think a third is... I'm surprised it's not higher, actually.
Maggie, have you downloaded anything legally first?
No, but I have been in the presence of people.
Oh, hang on.
No, I've been in the presence of people who do. And namely, I would say I have a 20-year-old student son, and what I notice about them and their student house is they don't have a TV. They just watch what they want when they want on their laptops or their tablets, and then maybe fiddle around with wires. And I think that is what's really going on amongst... I'd say the under 25s are really, really heavily into it.
Maggie, you hear this noise? Yeah, it's the police knocking at your son's door. He's going to be really grateful to you, isn't
he? Well, he doesn't live with me.
Well, that's all right, Mum. And finally this week, we turn our attention to the BBC. What do you mean about time? We always talk about the BBC. But today, and I've just come back, well, I'll tell you, I was very excited. I got an email from the BBC saying Glastonbury invite. Imagine the excitement.
Yeah.
Turns out it was an invite to their Glastonbury launch. But the BBC has announced that they will be streaming 250 hours of live coverage. You'll have to watch that online on your tablet or iPhone or whatever. There'll also be 34 hours of TV coverage and 59 hours on the radio, including Radio 2 in a big way for the first time. And also BBC One for the first time. So, Maggie, it's kind of Glasto's gone mainstream.
Well, I thought it had gone Olympics, actually. What struck me about it was that the coverage and the plan with the different red button options from the different stages struck me as almost a complete takeaway from the Olympics last year, which I thought worked brilliantly. And I actually think this sounds really good, because I've never gone to Glastonbury. I would never go to Glastonbury, but I am not...
You're very posh, Maggie.
No, but I'm too old, but I couldn't possibly... cope with the mud and I imagine the loose, but the point is that there are really good acts, but obviously they've had to cut between them. So if you can actually choose which band or group or whatever it is you want to watch, that's fantastic.
Presumably they'll be criticised for the amount of money they're spending on this, won't they? Because the Olympics, because actually I think you're absolutely right about the parallel with the Olympics, but that's seen as a sort of great unifying event for the whole country. And I can foresee some critical headlines in some newspapers saying this is the BBC spending a lot of money
on a pop festival. The point is now the BBC has to make the most of every big asset it has, and it has to use it in different ways. It can't just say, oh, we're here and we're just putting it out and edited bits and highlights here on one channel. If it's happening and it's a big festival, it is correct that it does it in this sort of big way, because that's really the way the world is. Because there are other rights that it's losing. The same goes for sport as well. So when it does something, yes, it should go in with both feet and really make a
but it's got to do it. I agree, but it's got to do it efficiently, hasn't it? Because the problem that you worry about sometimes with the BBC is that when it's doing it across multiple platforms, what it's not doing is taking the same content and moving it around, like you say, to make a bigger deal of it as possible.
But of course it's got to be efficient. I mean, the BBC is not as efficient as it could be, and there are many examples of it, including its a mess over its digital media project. But good management is one thing, but separately, the way forward is to exploit assets, including programming, in a lot of different ways, reusing program, you know, repeating programs, digital channels coming to back up maybe the main BBC One and BBC Two. All those things need to be rethought in the age that we're in now.
And still with Glastonbury, I think it remains to be seen, so we've been told, how much of the Rolling Stones sort of headline performance they'll show and whether it'll be live. Rights issues, apparently. But that would be a surprise, wouldn't it, if that didn't happen?
What, you mean we're not going to actually hear the performance in full?
It remains to be seen, yes. Do you remember last time around, Leonard Cohen wouldn't give them any permission any of his sets?
So. But this is the Stones' 50th anniversary. How can they cheat their fans in that way?
I'm sure it'll happen in some way, but apparently negotiations continue, so...
I thought that would have been locked down before they make their big announcements of the great splash that they're making with their digital coverage, you know, showing absolutely everything from the toilets upwards at Glastonbury, that they might not show the headline act live.
Well, we shall wait and see. But Maggie, before I talked about the Stones, you mentioned the Digital Media Initiative, the DMI fiasco, which has cost the licensee pair, the best part of 100 million quid.
I think it's really, really serious because... One of the things about a properly managed BBC is that if a project isn't working, it should have been abandoned, or it should be abandoned far earlier than this stage now, when you've basically spent £100 million getting nowhere. And given that when you read the letters that have gone backwards and forwards between Anthony Fry and the Public Accounts Committee, given the fact that the project was clearly in trouble long before this, in fact, it was in trouble almost from the start when they gave the initial proposal to Siemens, who then were removed.
This is all about me making the BBC tapeless.
Yes, yeah, almost like a YouTube channel that you can grab content if you're making a programme or audio from any other part of the BBC, so that in theory it's a very seamless way of, if you like, cutting and pasting. But this clearly is a project that is just too gigantic and has been overtaken anyway by developments. But the real thing about it, it just shows bad management at the BBC and a lack of real, what you might call, financial control. When projects like this are given to an executive, it's in the interests of the team concerned to keep them going. But what actually needs to happen in any other commercial organisation, you need to have an oversight so that you could say, no, this isn't working, and pull it. There's no shame in pulling something that isn't working. And what this revealed, because it has gone on since really 2008, is that there was no real oversight or proper reporting back to both the BBC Trust and, one suspects, maybe even the Executive Committee. I suspect that this has come out partly now with the change of Director General, because it's very hard for an incumbent to admit that one of these big technology projects, which the BBC has famously always loved to do and which seemed to be working with iPlayer, has gone so terribly wrong.
Nick Pollard, I remember when he unveiled the Pollard Report, he talked about the BBC existing in a bubble and the impact on the culture of having not having to worry about the bottom line. And this sort of feels like another sort of exhibit of that.
It does, the Tony Hall honeymoon does continue, in that he's still able in this situation, like you say, because he wasn't involved with any of this, to send those very headmasterly emails that he sends around and gets leaked immediately and appears on Media Guardian, where he sounds very tough and very sad when the BBC have cocked something up and we must never learn from these mistakes, it must never happen again. But the next test will be under his watch when something happens, because it's very easy when you when you join an organisation to constantly be apologising for things you never did because it was your predecessor. But there is a pressure on the BBC because I think, going back now, it's been a really bad year for the BBC or bad few months. And the test will always be, are you acting with the discipline of a commercial institution? And you speak to people from in broadcasting from commercial institutions, they'll always tell you the BBC doesn't really have regard for its bottom line. It doesn't have any of the efficiencies that you would expect from it. And this is a terrible, I mean, it's £100 million. It's a terrible example of a project that looked doomed to failure from the beginning and then was kept artificially alive by people not concerned ever about making money or getting value for money. And then Tony Hall sends email saying this must be never allowed to happen again. Well, that'll be the real test of his reign at the BBC, whether this type of white elephant project happens or doesn't happen again.
I think it's going to have an impact on licence fee negotiations as well, because it just is further proof that, as you say, public money is not necessarily being used in the correct manner.
OK, and that's it for this part of the show. Maggie Brown and Stig Abel, thank you very much. Time for part three now, and we're going to talk TV as ever. What else did you expect? With Rebecca Nicholson. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm all right.
Excellent. Now, there is a... Now, I'm no expert, but I can detect a historical theme there. First up, the return to CBBC of horrible histories.
Yes. The clue that it's historical may well be in the title.
Well, that's right. The theme gets harder to spot later on, but let's start here. Yeah, go on. Yeah. Now, this is a programme I've never seen, but I think I should have done.
You should watch it, I think. Do you have kids?
A two-year-old.
Then perhaps it might...
Give it a bit.
This is going to go over your two-year-old's head, right. But it's just a very good sketch show. I think whatever age you are, whatever your level of interest in history, it's informative and it's very funny. I mean, I say for a kids' show in a slightly patronising way, but as a sketch show, every sketch seems to hit the mark, and I think that's quite rare. And also, it taught me something about Archimedes. It taught me something about Victorian makeup through the medium of a Made in Chelsea spoof. There's a Ross Kemp on Gangs spoof.
Is on kids' TV?
It's all on kids' TV.
And it should be primetime BBC Two, at least.
It really should be primetime BBC Two. Or at least it would be... I wonder what would happen if it got a kind of later slot.
Is there any suggestion that might happen? Or
I don't know. Everyone looks very fondly on it and it's got a good reputation. But I think, I mean, it is obviously still a kids' show. It's just very funny.
Well, in fact, producer Matt tells me it had actually played in primetime BBC One.
Oh, yeah, they did an adults version, didn't they? But so that wasn't great.
In one sense, I was being very clever by suggesting it should be on primetime, so I didn't know it had been. But in another sense,
pretending to be an expert. Like,
entirely uninformed, because it had already been on. But anyway, I shall look at that next week. And another programme. Now, this historical theme, not necessarily so obvious. Up the Women.
Up the Women. This is a BBC Four comedy. It's been written by Jessica Hines of...
Spaced fame
and RTS Awards fame.
Oh, yes, 2012. Yeah, for younger listeners, 2012. For old, Spaced used to be a sitcom on Channel 4, produced by OWT. Anyway, carry on.
Yes, I was a huge fan of Spaced. I have the DVDs. I once met someone and we ended up talking about Spaced and she said, oh, yeah, I think I've seen that on YouTube. And the fact that I used to watch it in my student house made me feel very, very old.
There's a spin-off, Spaced 1999, which was about a couple who shared a flat on the moon and he got blasted out of lunar orbit. Yeah,
that's
one for really old listeners. Really, anyway, so great. Up the Women.
Written by Jessica Hines, and it's
of Spaced fame. Sorry.
It's a suffragette-based comedy.
Which is not a phrase you hear every day.
It's not a phrase you hear every day, but it's very of the moment. There's a lot of suffragette business about. It's 100 years since Emily Davison died. And I really wanted to love this.
Uh-oh.
It's got lots of people that I like in it. Rebecca Front is in it. Really good cast. Interesting premise, suffragette comedy. But it feels very old-fashioned and a little bit Radio 4. And it's...
Ooh.
Yeah, but I mean, you could close your eyes, and which I'm doing for the benefit of absolutely nobody, just closing my eyes to do it myself.
I can confirm that.
And it doesn't... There's nothing visual about it. It's just lots of kind of zingy lines, but not quite zingy enough. It's pleasant, but it isn't quite the thing I'd hoped it would be.
Radio 4 comedy. That's a phrase to give you the fear, but we'll return to that topic maybe
another
week.
It is a little bit Radio 4.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. Yeah. Okay, well, that's the series, though, isn't it? But you won't be returning to it.
Three episodes.
Right.
It's a mini-series. I've seen the first two. I will watch the third one. I don't think it's terrible.
Just find out what happens.
Yeah.
They get the vote.
Hey!
moving on. Psycho Bitches.
Well, this is also... on the same evening as Up the Women. This is Sky Arts, part of their Playhouse Presents Strand. And this is great. This is a real cracker. It's directed by Jeremy Dyson from League of Gentlemen. A couple of the League of Gentlemen pop up in it in various guises. But the premise is women from history in a therapy session talking to Rebecca Front, who plays this kind of straight
The ubiquitous Rebecca Front, by the sounds of it.
The ubiquitous Rebecca Front. She must never have a break. And it's very funny. It's very dark. It's darker than I expected. And actually, having watched that after Up the Women, it was pleasingly dark. But you have Sharon Horgan playing Eva Peron. There's Audrey Hepburn in there. Julia Davis is Sylvia Plath. This is a lot funnier than it sounds.
My God, the talent involved.
It's absolutely brilliant cast. Huge writing team. Although, disappointingly, not as many women on the writing team as you might expect from something that's so female-centric. Nevertheless, it's a very, very funny show. Very dark. Lots of League of Gentlemen moments in it.
With Mark Gatiss in it as well, yeah?
Yes, he plays... you can see this on the Guardian TV website. He plays...
Beautifully done.
Joan Crawford. In
of course he does.
Excellent sketch with Frances Barber as Betty Davis. And they loathe each other. It's very, very funny.
There's an extra
Virginia
in a
Woolf is in there. My only slight complaint, which isn't really a complaint, but it's quite comedy for English literature graduates. There's a sketch with the Bronte sisters in there.
Are you saying it's a bit Radio 4?
No, this really isn't Radio 4. It's a bit... I don't know what its radio equivalent would be.
Well, we'll have to leave it there for this week. I think Sky Arts just had the nod over BBC Four there, but CBBC, that beat both of them. My thanks to all this week's guests, who were, in no particular order, except the one I read them out in, Mr. Stig Abel and Maggie Brown and Rebecca Nicholson. You can leave your thoughts on this week's show on our Facebook wall or our blog, or you can tweet me at JohnPlunkett149. Media Talk is produced, as ever, by the award-winning Mr. Matt Hill. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.